There's a river flowing in my soul.
The second part of our conversation with John and Catherine takes us beneath the surface of behavior. John explains the social cognitive model behind coping power, how children read social situations, feel physical arousal, generate possible responses, weigh consequences, and act all within family, peer, school, and neighborhood contexts. One practical implication: children who look similarly aggressive or disruptive may be having very different internal experiences. Some quickly read hostility where an observer would not. Some become highly aroused and struggle to settle back down. Some are shaped by peer groups that reinforce aggression. These differences matter because they change what kind of support is likely to help. Catherine and John also unpack a real dilemma practitioners face: when to use group interventions and when not to. Groups offer practice, belonging, and positive peer reinforcement. But for some young people with poor behavioral inhibition, high reactivity, or certain forms of peer susceptibility, the group itself can become the part of the problem, and individual delivery may work better. The conversation is also about exclusion. When schools remove young people without understanding what is driving their behavior, they can concentrate students together in ways that reinforce the very dynamics they hope to change. A more useful starting point is curiosity. What is this behavior doing for the young person? What happens right before, during, and after the moments we see? As you listen, notice how science and research data help us make specific choices: group versus individual delivery, attention to families and peers, support for emotional regulation, and a willingness to revise the plan when a child's response tells us that the first plan was not the right one. Catherine and John, I want to draw on both of your experiences in different aspects of multi-tiered approaches. John, coping power is an individual approach that is sometimes delivered in a group context. You also were a co-PI on the fast track intervention, which was a very powerful multi-tiered intervention. And Catherine, you, in a whole bunch of work and studies that you've done that has focused on school climate, combining positive behavioral interventions and supports with social emotional learning, as just examples, you've really been looking at multi-tiered interventions. What can a focused intervention approach, its theory, its active ingredients, its intensity or clarity, become harder to preserve when the components are combined? And what can a well-aligned combination accomplish that a single program cannot? And let me give a second reason to be behind this question. In a follow-up episode, we'll be listening to a bunch of people focusing on intervention science. And one of the points that sometimes is made by intervention scientists is the simpler things are, the less complex they are, the easier it is to get them right. And that's right. But at the same time, there are reasons why we need things that are more complex and are a little less simple. So we need to really learn about how we can do them well. So this is a question to either of you can start, and then I'd like to hear from both of you.
I could kick us off here and then pass it over to John. He and I recently co-edited a book on this exact topic. It's entitled Cognitive Behavioral Interventions for Children with Aggressive Behavior. And we are really focused on coping power as an example of this type of approach. As you've heard from John, his work has been in play for several decades, 30 years or plus, taking this particular framework and adapting it for different contexts and adapting it for different youth populations. And we really wanted to feature that in the book, particularly attentive to issues around implementation science. So not only what works for whom, under what conditions, and what kind of minor adaptations or perhaps sweeping adaptations that can be made to increase the effectiveness of the intervention. As you heard about his work with Tom DeShawn, they tested an individual versus a group model. And we've also seen adaptations for other cultural contexts, for special populations like children with disabilities. My particular interest has also been in adaptations for adolescents in high school settings, which are a very different animal than you would see in an elementary school with a traditional pullout. We've also done tiered interventions where we've gone back to the classroom and taken elements of coping power and pushed into the classroom to be able to complement and help children that are in those pullout groups or the tier two intervention help generalize skills so everybody learns some of the basic concepts, one of which is a problem-solving model called PIC, the PIC model. And it's really a basic concept that is used in a lot of different cognitive interventions, helping kids pick apart a different type of problem. But as you can imagine, having kids that are in the pullout, if they're the only ones learning that kind of problem-solving model, and they go on the playground or they have some kind of challenge in the classrooms, they're trying to pick it apart, but nobody else is. But having a general common structure and language that is used more intensively for the kids with a little bit more support needs relative to the other kids, it can also benefit from having a good, solid research-based problem-solving model. So this is just an example of the different adaptations that Coping Power has been going through over the several years and rigorous evaluations of that.
I can speak to the issue about Fast Track just very quickly. I think Fast Track began back in 1989, 1990, and there was some interest at NIMH at that time of trying to fund kind of these maximal approaches to having an impact on children with conduct problems and to do this in kind of preventive ways. And so we came together, our PI group, John Cooey, Ken Dodge, Mark Greenberg, Karen Bierman, Bob McMahon, and I came together to develop the Fast Track program. The initial steps for Fast Track were to think about what we can put together in this program to make a lifelong difference for the children. We created an intervention that started in first grade, ran all the way to 10th grade with changes across the way. It involved child groups and parent groups across many years' time, but also included peer pairing, focusing on social skills, parent-child interaction work, home visits, and tutoring. So lots of bits and pieces in there that we felt would help to address some of the risk factors that these children had. And then there was PAS, so that was the full classroom part of the program. And it was invaluable. It's great data because it shows across time what happens when you have a major effect on children and their families. And within that study, we're now out looking at G3. So that's the children of the children we worked with, right? But what you can't do are probably two things. So one is you can't very easily see how any given element or component of that program was important. You just know the whole thing was important. And then that has a lot of implications for the second issue, which is that it's very difficult then to disseminate this huge program. Its application, its ability to affect the public health is not great, unfortunately. It's great for research and for understanding, but not for that. It's very difficult for that. So I think we took with Coping Power, it's a different approach as Catherine was talking about. We found that this base model essentially works. It's got two pieces too. It's got a child component and a parent component. There was efficacy for that. And then that became a platform to then add other things on and test them. So we could test the full classroom approach, which is what Catherine has done. We could test other ways of trying to affect some of these mechanisms. So we have a mindful coping power version where you've added in mindfulness training. So you can take that base, that platform, and then add other things to it. Did that make a difference or not? It can really tell better what are the key features there.
Catherine, do you want to add what you have, other things that you have learned from Fast Track that I know you have been interested in? And I want to also have you bring in something that you talked about in our previous conversation, the notion of an operating system.
Sure. I first learned about the Fast Track work when I was doing my master's degree in counseling and was working more in juvenile justice settings. And then when I transitioned into more school-based prevention. It was really a guidepost for the work that I did. And as I was learning more about not only the design, but how they knit together the different evidence-based practices and sequence them developmentally, I launched into a series of projects around multi-tiered systems of support when I joined the faculty at Johns Hopkins in the early 2000s. That's when I first met John and got to work with him through some of the work we were doing with my colleague Nikai Longo and our National Institute of Mental Health funded center there. And in addition to thinking about developmental adaptations for coping power at the middle and high school level, we also started thinking about what if we put this on the menu of other evidence-based practices and have gone in to do a couple of different trials where we allowed schools that were leveraging data on school climate, identifying different kinds of screeners and referrals to the office for students and saying, well, what do we do at tier two? What do we do at tier three? And they were very attracted to the coping power model. And so that's been one of the evidence-based practices we've placed on a menu, so to speak, of other EBPs that they can select based on data to drive that decision. That's not only have we tested it as a standalone, but in the context of some of these larger initiatives. And I think there are great benefits of doing both kinds of studies, but when it comes to real world settings, schools are doing all kinds of different things. And when you want to optimize the implementation of any kind of, whether it be coping power or PAS or some other curriculum, having a school-wide system that is focused on using data to make decisions, having a system for reinforcing those kinds of practices and providing training, and also having coaching and implementation supports to make sure whatever you're doing, that you're doing well and that you're guiding good choices around program selection. And so I've been a big advocate of thinking not only about the evidence-based practice itself, but what is the operating system that's being able to host it to make sure that we're optimizing implementation. And that led us to, after we had done the middle and the high school work with Coping Power, we started thinking about scale-up models for Coping Power. And based on some of the feedback that we had, to an earlier point you had made, David, like what's the least amount of work you can do for the biggest impact? And so we started thinking about, all right, what are some of the core components of Coping Power that are the non-negotiables, so to speak, that we still really need to do, but are the ways that we can peel back some of the layers of it? For example, we found that some of the parents weren't always coming in, and there are challenges with parents these days in terms of dual career and other kinds of factors. And some parents just don't feel comfortable coming into the school setting. And while we tried many different strategies to further engage the parents, we also got feedback, can you deliver some of this to me at home or through alternate strategies like online? So we've been using a nudge technique, a video technique to deliver videos of some of the content to parents at home to reinforce the skills. As John had mentioned, using that ecological framework, what they're learning at school, how can we extend that? There's some cons to that because they don't get the group dynamic of parents interacting and hearing from one another, but they're getting some of the content. And so we've been scaling that up through another project. And then also pushing down into the classroom and then the pull-out program. And our recent research does show that there is a synergistic effect by not just doing the classroom component, but also kids that get that pull-out have an added benefit in the synergistic effect that's occurring there. I like to think about schools as a working environment that's very active and they get to make decisions. Another challenge that they have is like we refer kids for the program. Screeners are one approach that we've used a lot in the research, and John can talk about a bit around that. But we also heard folks saying, what about kids with internalizing program? Can they benefit from coping power too? And so rather than just focusing exclusively on externalizing problems, we've also been using a screener to identify kids that might have some co-occurring problems with internalizing issues and have found some benefit or crossover effects of the coping power intervention to kids with internalizing problems. And schools sometimes say, I just can't do a screener. I've got too much going on. What if we take referrals to the office as some other method? And so these are ways that we've been tinkering with the model to try to fit within the school environment rather than imposing a formal structure, but having those non-negotiables in place, thinking about how we can optimize implementation through coaching, the use of data, and good systems to support high quality implementation.
Thinking about that whole system as a real strength that Catherine has. I think certainly within Fast Track, we were interested in having an impact at the school level. I really appreciate her thinking, sharpening how to do that. We do know from some of our coping power work that context around at the school does make a difference. School counselors who are leading the program, if they're in schools where they feel that for example, that the principal is setting up horizontal decision making rather than real strict, harsh, vertical decision making, where the staff feel like they're being treated as autonomous professionals when that's true in a school, the counselor who's delivering coping power does it with greater quality. The quality of implementation is better. And they're also more likely to continue to use that program several years after we're done with them. We're out of their hair. We're gone. But they still have all the materials, and they're more likely to continue to use the program if they feel there was support and this kind of atmosphere there. The other part about just being in the school, I think this is more of a part of the intervention itself, but I've really moved in recent years away from just thinking about kind of delivering intervention and it's these manuals that we do, but it's who is delivering the intervention. Who is that person? And so it's intervention process. And so we found that the personality characteristics of that counselor makes a difference. Counselors who have personality characteristics of being more conscientious and more agreeable implement the program better. The kids do better academically years later if they have those kind of leaders. And then we've looked at the behaviors in the session. What is in a group session? What are some of these leaders doing? And the leaders who have high levels of what we code as clinical skill, it's being warm and positive, flexible, and not frustrated, angry, or irritable. If you just look at that, independent of the program, your kids are going to look a lot better in terms of reductions in externalizing behavior years later, right? On top of the program. So it's something about, I think it's the frustrated, angry, irritable part that's really important. I think the warm part is important. But I think that by definition in a group, we're putting these group leaders in a situation that is periodically frustrating and irritating, right? These kids are going to be non-compliant. They're going to be difficult. They're going to be, and the people who have that capacity to deal with those difficult moments and continue on, move on with the program, do things. We think that what they're doing is they're modeling something to these kids, that these kids have lacked this ability, this schema for how do you handle this arousal. And this isn't something that gets added into their schema, that they can have that impact. So we think that these issues are really important. Who and is leading that program, and how can we have an impact on that?
John, that last point is really important in terms of the who. And I want to connect it to some thinking I've done, but also a conversation that you and I had in a group, Catherine, I'd say a decade and a half ago, about good enoughness. You may remember it. That I was once at a global implementation conference where someone said, when an evidence-based practice, think coping power, they didn't say that, comes to a new place, all it is a promising practice. And I think that point is really important because every school has its own ecology. And that ecology includes everything from the structures, the operating systems, if they're there or not, through the way people act, through the dispositions and the aggregated dispositions that you were just talking about, John. We're never going to have every teacher or every clinician to be the right person. And we may not be able to always create the right mix. What are the things that we can do? And I'm thinking here the we is people working on the ground as practitioners, or people who support the practitioners by creating the conditions where they work, so that things can work good enough, powerfully enough, so that it is much more likely that the people who are doing coping power, for example, have the right dispositions.
Now, let me add, I can say a couple things first, and then Catherine, you jump in here. I think that we have looked at in a pretty general way at intensity of training of staff and what makes a difference. And more intensive training does lead to better outcomes. And I think the key part of that model when we did that was the issue of performance feedback. So really collecting data about how that counselor is delivering the program in session three and then coding it, really giving it, looking at it very carefully, and then giving feedback back to that clinician. Because I think in a lot of cases, the clinicians, let's say they're not being as warm and positive as they could be, and maybe they're being more irritable than they should be. But I think that many people with feedback can find their own ways to master that in the moment, right? They may need a support group to help them sometimes, but the feedback is important, right? So there's the opportunity for them to receive that in a constructive way, and then to try to, in my next session, this is what I'm going to do differently. So I'm going to try to do it differently. And I think that can make a difference for a good chunk of these people, not all of them, but a good chunk of them.
Catherine, I know you have worked in that feedback space, and so do you want to elaborate further?
Sure, I think John highlighted the importance of data to guide decisions in coaching. We think a lot about coaching and implementation support, and one of the elements of an effective coaching relationship is motivation for change. And people come at a change process at different points in their motivation or their drive. Some people are doing it, let's say a school decides that they're going to adopt something and that the principal has said, "We will do coping power," or "We will do positive behavior support." People come at that with different kinds of expectations and motivating factors. And we find that within the context of authentic buy-in for the change process and coaching and data to guide that process, we see much more effective change than the must-do, have-to-do kind of framework. We use motivational interviewing as a practice, and our toolkit when we're using coaching is also for our training. And some schools may see that they have different experiences with certain models and come at coping power, other kind of practices, with maybe some resistance of, "I've been there before, this hasn't worked for me, I'm not very motivated to adopt this practice." And we see that implementation quality really suffers as a result. So you have to really start at ground zero working with them to understand what are conditions that they could feel successful and have efficacy to implement the practice. Does it look like it's a good fit for their classroom? Are there elements that are harder or easier for them to implement? And certainly coping power has the pull-out component. So we've been talking largely about that as a clinician-based practice. But even just more generally, we see that when we provide training for a whole host of interventions, when people are sitting there in the training and they're thinking, "Is this a fit for my classroom? Am I really ready to go? Am I motivated? Am I ready to partner with somebody for high quality implementation?" Those are very robust predictors of whether people are actually going to try out that practice. And so we need to provide some scaffolding around that, because perhaps we could just screen people in and say, "Oh, you're not motivated," or, "You don't have efficacy, we're going to pass by you." But that's not the real world. We have to be thinking about those conditions for success and how we can build on that. Data can be helpful, and sometimes in a coaching relationship, getting somebody to go is getting them to the go point or the starting point is a big part of that shoulder-to-shoulder work. We've built on some of the work that Wendy Rinke has done with the classroom checkup that uses elements of motivational interviewing that were developed by Milner and Rolnick, and also have been used in other family practices like Tom DeShawn had used in the family checkup. We've adapted that more recently to focus on culturally responsive practices, because there's a lot of movement and conversation about those practices. But without the context of a good coaching relationship and strong motivation, we find that people are really very anxious about adopting practices, or maybe think that they're already doing things and aren't open to the feedback that's provided.
This conversation is great, and it really connects both to our episode 8, which is going to impart that's on implementation science and will include Abe Wandesman talking about readiness,
Oh,
which is a
great. Yeah.
combination of people's motivation, as you would say, as well as their individual capacities to do the work, which gets to John's point of their dispositions. And you've talked about how that can be shaped a little, as well as the organizational conditions in which they operate. And when John talked about different leadership approaches and how that may affect what counselors are doing, that's a good example. And in episode 2, we talked about the report that Rob Jaggers, Wemba Jones, and I had done, which was on teacher and student well-being, where one of the points we were making is that if we really want interventions to work, we have to be attentive to the well-being of all the teachers. And that would be also all the other educators, the practitioners, because their own ability to do the different things that John's talking about are affected by their well-being. And so this is not for me to preach, but rather to open it up to you for your closing thoughts. regarding what people who are listening to this and doing their really hard work now, who may not have access to coping power tomorrow and may not have access to fast track ever, can do to really make a difference. And I'll start with you, John, and then I'll go to Catherine.
I do think that we know a lot about not just programs, but practices that make a difference in working with kids. And I think that in our research work over the years, we've looked a lot at programs, coping power being a program, and we test that. But there are elements within coping power that we could think of as practices. And an individual, if you're in an environment where you can't do the full program, you may well be able to do some of the practices. You may be able to help children use, for example, some of the skills to help them to manage that sympathetic nervous system over arousal, right? And you could pull out ways to have them practice that and use breathing and use other skills to help manage that. So I think it's, if you can't do a full program, there are pieces of these things that we know work and that people have researched. Same is true in parenting. So I would encourage people to do that, I think, with the goal of thinking about this child who's having these difficulties as having this dysregulation, emotional and cognitive dysregulation inside them. And can we do little bits of things to help that? And can we help that environment around them?
Before Catherine comes in, I want to remind the listeners that they ought to think about or go listen to Stephanie Jones's podcast, where she talks about both strategies and SEL kernels. Because of the fact that while you have not done the empirical work here yet, John, for the kernel, you really are describing why the kernels work, and that you don't have to always wait for the empirical work to start doing those things. Catherine, your thoughts?
I think John really honed in on the importance of the different core components of the model and how those can be transported. And I do think it's important for us to also consider the context in which these interventions are developed and how planned adaptations under, particularly in the support of a coach and an implementation specialist, can really be very powerful and impactful. It can help build efficacy to implement the model. It can also build motivation. It can also optimize outcomes for students. So we have to think about what are those planned adaptations that are appropriate. Sometimes people have a shopping cart, oh, I'll grab a little bit of this, a little bit of that. But there is a scope and sequence to a lot of interventions, and it's important to be attentive to those and be thoughtful about which elements are brought together. And having a broader system and a framework and a logic for implementing those practices and/or programs is really very critical. Like the emphasis on data to drive the process and to inform feedback, including data on implementation quality, and having a broader communication strategy with the home environment as well as the classroom. So that way, even if you're just doing the pull-out program, teachers need to know and be coached about what kind of supports they can help reinforce in the classroom setting, just as parents need support about how they can reinforce those skills at the home setting. So some kind of connectivity, even if you distill it down to the parts, we still can't lose that importance of the ecological framework from which children are developing and experiencing, and we need to think about touch points at all of those different levels when possible.
John or Catherine, do you want to have anything added to this conversation?
The only thing I would add, I think, is I think what I've learned from some of these adaptations of the program has been really important for me. And one of the best examples of that in my own experience has been the adaptation of the program to be used in Pakistan. You have to adapt the program to use it in Sweden and Italy and the Netherlands and that kind of thing. It has to be adapted. It has to fit those environments. But the environment in Pakistan was really quite different. And what was so impressive with Asia Mushtaq, who did that work, was how she brought in elements of the Quran, some of the Islamic practices, focusing on patience and handling anger, things that are part of that system that those kids would have experienced, and bringing it in and making it very much a part of the program. So I think that is so impressive, seeing how people out there in the world can take these elements, these mechanisms, and work with them within their environment, very different cultures.
Catherine?
I do want to thank you for providing an opportunity to feature this line of work. And while it's focused on coping power, it really does have illustrations and implications for other evidence-based practices.
I want to thank you both. This has been lovely.